Session number 8655, Real 5.
Mr. Weiberg, Real 5. I think you're telling me what happened as far as you found out later, after the ambush.
Oh, yes. I don't think the column really went any further. I think they were withdrawn from that position, because to go further would have meant a properly organised operation, because it was hilly country and the enemy were in a very strong position in the hills. And as that was, there was no intention really to use that route to get at the enemy main force, there was no point in presumably in getting casualties attacking.
On your way up the road, did you pass through any other recognisable Italian positions?
No, only these camps where they spent a period of time.
So you didn't see any of their field works or anything like that?
No.
Before you were actually forced to withdraw by running up against the Italian rear guard, were you able to form any impression of what sort of position they had occupied? And
what, the ambush?
Yes.
No, only that they were just in this. It happened as soon as we entered this hilly position. As we advanced down the road, we had hills to our left and in front, and then eventually we actually started to go up. On the road became slightly on an incline and more curving, and as it went up into the hills, and it happened just there. And of course, again, it was quite thick vegetation. And if they were using medium machine guns and artillery, you see, and they had an outpost, an OP, somewhere up high up, they would have been able to see us coming along without us, and given the order to open fire without us seeing them.
Do you know if the mobile column had any casualties?
There was one other casualty besides myself, but it wasn't serious. That's the only one I know about.
What about losses of equipment? Did they manage to brew up any of the trucks or carriers?
Well, Baggett's carrier was blown up more than once, but I don't think it was ever a write-off. I think these mines that the Italians used, I don't think they had a great lot of force behind them. I think they probably broke the track, which would have been repairable.
What did your men do then when the firing began? Did they get off the trucks and on either side of the
road?
Yeah,
well, yes, I told them, get off truck, D truck, or what we said at the time, and I sent part of the platoon to one side of the road and part to the other side of the road, so that if there was any attempt for the enemy to come down towards us, then we would be in a position to repulse them.
But the enemy didn't, actually.
No, they didn't do that.
When you were withdrawing and you were actually wounded, have you any idea what kind of shell it was that...
I saw it explode. I think it was a very small calibre shell, presumably from pack artillery.
And how far from the place where, where you'd been stopped by the ambush were you at that time?
Oh, 20 or 30 yards. We just started our withdrawal when it happened. We were still in the area which was under fire, although the fire had slackened considerably by then. That's why we got back into the trucks to go back.
How long did the initial burst of fire last then before it slackened off?
Oh, I should think about 10 minutes.
And did your own artillery or infantry fire back?
No, we didn't. No, there was no... I couldn't see. You see, I was on the road by the vehicle and looking, and I couldn't see a thing. Because obviously the enemy were at a higher point, and there was all these, there was a lot of trees, and you couldn't see anything at all. And they weren't firing from a close position. They were medium machine guns, you see, and firing from some considerable distance. And I didn't see anything at all.
Did the shell that wounded you do any damage to the vehicle?
No, I don't think it did. The vehicle, no, it didn't do any other damage.
Now, you mentioned earlier on that you came across some Eritreans in the elephant grass.
Mm-hmm.
How many of them were there?
About half a dozen.
And what did they do when you approached them?
Well, nothing. They were only two. By that time, they'd run out of steam by then, you see. They were stragglers, really, who, for some reason, had got left behind by the main force. And they were they had a couple of them had a mule with medical equipment on it. And I suppose they'd dilly-dallied, you see, and then they'd been overtaken by us unexpectedly. And then they tried to get past us during the night, failed to do. Well, some may have done successfully, of course, we don't know. But they didn't, and by the morning, two or three of them had been killed and were being buried by then, because they were... That was the first time, I think, that I came across that particular smell that you get from a recently dead body. And so I think they were only too pleased to give themselves up.
What sort of uniforms and equipment did they have?
Well, they had a sort of rather unkempt grey cotton uniform and rifles. Sort of very bare essentials as far as equipment was concerned.
How did they signify their wish to surrender?
By doing nothing. Just waiting to be... you just walked over to them and pulled them to their feet, and then they acquiesced.
How did you speak to them, or didn't you?
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't do anything like that. I just arranged for them to be put into a little group and under guard and sent back down the road.
Did they look as though they were in reasonable physical condition?
Oh, yes. Yes, they did. They just looked unhappy.
How long did your signals course in Egypt last?
Well, that was 6 weeks.
And what were the main elements of the syllabus?
Well, you did some sort of basic physics, electricity and magnetism, so that you could understand the workings of telephones and that sort of thing. And then there was you learnt about laying cables. Telephones were extremely important in those days because wireless was primitive, and in any case infantry units didn't have any wireless at all, and so telephones were very important. So the accent was really on the laying of cable. And of course, making knots, tying the lengths of cable together, joints,
splicing.
Yes, I think we called it joints, and the telephones themselves and their maintenance, and then exchanges. An infantry battalion had a small telephone exchange. And all these things are very difficult to keep in working order in dusty and sandy places, because the sand and the dust used to get on the terminals, you see, and prevent the electricity from passing across. And then someone would ring up, and the exchange wouldn't get a signal because the electricity wasn't flowing through it because of the dust on the terminals. And then tactics, there would be sort of exercises where you would pretend that there was an attack taking place, and you had to go out and decide how you were going to make the best use of your resources in the way of cable and telephones, because you only had a certain amount of cable and a certain number of telephones. Of course, in the event... you often were in a situation where you could beg, borrow, or steal extra equipment, which you did if at all possible, and or pick up old cable that had been laid by somebody else and left there, and that sort of thing. So you in the event, in actual operations, you probably had far more equipment than you were supposed to. But you were taught to make the best use of your resources. And it was an interesting course. And I went back to the battalion, and I became the signal officer at once, which I enjoyed doing that.
What signalling equipment did the battalion have?
Well, at that time we had In fact, we had signal lamps and heliographs and even flags. And it sounds ludicrous now, but we did. And in fact, before the war, a lot of my signallers that I took over in April 1941, when I got to Asmara, had been signallers before the war, and they had been taught semaphore. And so we used to use semaphore to an extent. But this equipment in the way of lamps and heliographs, when it comes to the point when you're actually in a combat situation, it's not much good, because as soon as you flash a heliograph or a lamp, you give your position away. And you couldn't really, in warfare, even in those days, particularly in desert conditions, stand up in the middle of the desert and semaphore. So really, it really boiled down to telephones and cable, and instructing the men, you see, in the use of it. And that was very important, training the men to use the telephones and the cable and keep them in working order. And a good storeman who mended the equipment, if he was a good man, he was worth his weight in gold. And later on, we did, of course, have wireless sets. These were rather large compared with the ones you see now. They were carried on a man's back, and with another man following behind to operate the dials and wearing the headphones. And they were quite tricky. But we didn't have those in Abyssinia at all.
You didn't have any radios whatsoever?
Not in the battalion. They had them in higher formations, of course, but we didn't have them.
What state were the battalion in when you rejoined them in Asmara?
Well, not bad, considering they had a tough time at Kerin, quite a lot of casualties, and there were big changes. The main changes were that people who are officers, even regular officers, who'd still been second lieutenants when I left, I went back to find that they were majors, even second in command and that sort of thing, because of the casualties. And there was a lot of rank. They went up and down in rank. You know, they became majors overnight, and then somebody, reinforcements came who were senior to them, and so they went down a rank. That sort of thing went on. But I think the battalion was in pretty good heart in Asmara, because they won a battle. They won a very important battle. And the Asmara was a nice place to be in, and there were places to go and shops where they could buy cameras and gold watches for very little money because of the artificial rate of exchange. I think it was quite a happy place.
Had they been much reduced by casualties?
Yes. I think they had, not disastrously so.
Did they get any reserves coming up as reinforcements?
I don't remember any reinforcements there. I think the reinforcing would have awaited our transshipment to Egypt rather than send the reinforcements all the way down to Eritrea. We didn't take any part, you see, in the recapture of Abyssinia after Kerin. That was done by other parts of the division.
So what were you doing while you were in Asmara? Was it purely rest?
Well, it was rest and guard duties, really. Prisoners of war were kept in the fort in Asmara, and they had to be guarded. And the police had stopped being very effective, and their job had been taken over by British troops. So guard duties, really.
How did you get on with the Italians in Asmara?
Well, very well. They were quite... they bore no grudge, as far as I could see. And we used to go sometimes to this restaurant in Asmara, and we would have a meal, but I mean, there was no alcohol available. That had all long since been consumed, and so we used to take bottles of whiskey from the mess, and just they used to provide us with water and glasses. We'd drink our own drink in their restaurant. They didn't seem to mind, and there was a little restaurant And you could go up to the leader of the rest of the little orchestra, I mean to say. It was a little orchestra, and you could ask it to play tunes for you, and it would do so quite happily. And there was a barber shop where I went once and had my hair cut, and they were all very amicable.
Did they express any views about the war?
Not that I came across, no.
Did you see anything of the native population?
Not in Asmara, no. I don't remember native population in Asmara. This was Eritrea, you see, and of course the Italians have been there since the 1890s. And on one occasion we were sent off to a small town near, about 20 miles away, to search it for arms and hoarded food, and they were all Italians there.
Did you find anything?
No.
How long were you in Asmara then, before you were ordered to move
on? 2 months. About 2 months. And then we got on this train that spiralled down the mountains to Massawa, which is the port on the Red Sea. And, of course, it was quite cool in Asmara, because it's about 6,000 feet above sea level. And as the train sort of spirals down the mountains, it gets hotter and hotter, and it feels like being lowered into an oven. And then we got to Massawa, and it was terribly hot. This was June, the middle of the summer. Temperature was goodness knows what. It could have been 120 in the shade, I should think. And the men were passing out all over the place on the quayside. They were carrying their kit bags, and I think a lot of them had cameras and various other articles of loot with them, which overburdened them. And however, as the day went on, the extreme heat passed off. I think we got there about midday, which couldn't have been the worst time. And they recovered. We got on board this ship.
How did you actually get on the ship?
I think there were gangways. I think the ship must have been moored up right up against the quay, and we went aboard on gangways.
Did you have time to form any impression of Massawa as a place?
No, I only ever really saw. We must have got off. I don't remember how we got from the train to the quay side. I just think probably the train went right to the quay side, and I think it did. So we didn't really see anything of it.
Do you think you learned any important lessons from your experiences in this campaign?
Well, yes, because it was the first campaign I'd been involved in. It was the first time I'd been shot at. It was the first time I'd seen how I personally reacted and how other people reacted when being shot at. And without it being one of those dreadful experiences where a lot of people get killed, it was really a very good introduction to war, really, because it was instructive without being disastrous. And you learned how to handle your men and how to get them to move around as you wanted them to. Away from the restrictions of barracks, away from the restrictions of men who were absent because they were on fatigues of various kinds. And you live with your men. You didn't live in an officer's mess separated from your men except when on parade. You lived actually close by them all the time. And I think that was very important.